From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. A recent conference at the center examined the world economy and its relationship to world forests and forestry in the 20th century. Soundings invited several of the participants to reflect from both historical and contemporary viewpoints on some of the issues of the conference, which was sponsored by the Center for International Studies at Duke University. For example, scholars have only recently begun to examine environmental issues, such as deforestation, in cumulative historical terms. Moreover, historians are now examining the environment as a manifestation of cultural interdependence with social and political as well as economic consequences, particularly with an eye to third world societies. The panelists in the following portion of the discussion about the world economy and world forests are Richard Tucker, Michael Williams, Norman Myers, and John Richards. Richard Tucker is an environmental historian at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. Michael Williams teaches in the School of Geography at Oxford University. Norman Myers is an independent researcher from Oxford, England. John Richards teaches history at Duke University. The discussion begins with comments by Richard Tucker about the connections between the world's forests and economic development.
I think of this historically. We could think of any number of examples. What we all seem to be working towards is some sense of what the most productive balance will be between forest land, grasslands, agricultural land, the different kinds of uses that our own species and other species make of all of our soil and water and vegetation resources. For example, if we were in France, northern France, in the year 1000, we'd have confronted virtually unlimited forest land. And as the people then and there did, they needed more land to grow crops. And they assumed that there was virtually unlimited forest resource. And within another 200 years or so, the balance had shifted very much to more agricultural land, less forest land. And of course, more recently, we've had a lot of examples of this in the history of the U.S. and Canada as well. At no point was there any really serious total lack of forest. And in Europe and in North America since then, there's more forest land now than there was when agriculture reached its maximum extent. But this is very, very different from many of the third world countries now, where the balance has shifted so much towards agriculture and so much away from forest that hundreds of millions of people in the third world who still cook their food and who still keep their warmth at night and in the cold season by using firewood have increasingly desperate trouble finding any firewood. If they can grow the food but they can't cook it, it's a severe difficulty for them. But then, of course, there's so many other situations in which the relationship of forest to cropland and development in general is so very different that we have to look at different kinds of landscapes, different kinds of ecosystems, different ways in which the land is being used. And one of the interesting things in this conference this week has been discussions of areas in which just a few people own a lot of land, and most people don't have very much control at all over how their land is being used. That gets us into a whole additional range of really political issues.
Is there an example of really good and really bad management on the part of governments? Is there any rhyme or reason to the way governments control forests?
Yes, I think governments do have a great role. In the United States, if we look back, we can see how the way in which the government from around about the 1880s onwards became increasingly concerned about the devastation of forest land in the United States. And slowly the national forests were accumulated and government policy was enacted through the Forestry Bureau. And very forward-looking policies for that time and for the world as a whole were enacted specifically for the United States. They, of course, in the United States, from that time and perhaps even up to the present, one of the problems has been the private forest owner. But it's quite encouraging to see how in the last few decades the private forest owner has in fact been very receptive to ideas of good forest management and we can point to many, many excellent examples of watershed control, soil erosion control, good management of forest stands for the production of timber and for firewood, which is still used in a surprising large quantity in the United States. So it's not a problem just for the third world. But there are good examples where private and government have worked sort of in a cooperative way to bring about good forest management. And that's an ideal which other countries obviously have got to look towards.
There seems to be a pattern among nations of both the developed and the developing world whereby forestry comes pretty low down in the pecking order of priorities among government departments. I believe that this has arisen because governments have traditionally looked upon their forests and they've said, well, there's lots of those trees out there from one horizon to another We're not going to use them up. Why invest money in protecting them or safeguarding them or managing them? Let's just exploit them. They'll be there. So government budgets have tended to favor the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Commerce, the Ministry of Education, and whatever other big bureaucracy. Forestry has tended to suffer from what you might call a Cinderella syndrome. It's a little itsy-bitsy department right down at the end of the corridor. And this has applied, as I say, not only in developed nations, but especially in developing nations. There is fortunately now signs of a turnaround in Indonesia, Thailand, Nigeria, Peru. We can see some signs in a few countries that forestry is being recognized as an economic sector that supports a whole line of other sectors. It supports agriculture and communications, education, public health, and it's now being recognized for what it is. But this new trend is only a start. There's a long way to go yet.
I think we can say that the wealth of the United States in the late 18th, early 19th century was very largely built upon timber and wood. One commentator, I remember reading this somewhere, and one commentator in the early 19th century said, well may this be called a wooden country. We live on wood, we have wood in every conceivable way, and it is perhaps salutary to remember that the prosperity of large areas of the United States, the whole creation of farmland of large areas of the United States, has been on the basis of forest clearance.
I would just suggest that we are talking about two different kettles of fish, if you will, when we talk about forests in North America and other parts of the temperate zones and forests in the tropics. I think the situation has been grossly confused by our use of the one term forest to describe a bunch of trees such as we see outside the window here in North Carolina and a bunch of trees in Amazonia. They really are two different entities. When the settlers arrived in North America and they cleared away those many, many thousands of square miles of forest east of the Mississippi, I guess most people on the whole would think that it was a good thing. You ended up with a lot of extra farmlands, you didn't lose much soil through erosion, you lost hardly any wildlife species, the passenger pigeon and one or two others, and that was about it. You didn't upset the local climate. On the whole, you came out ahead, and the same with countries in Europe. But to transfer that philosophy to the tropics is a grave error. Most of the land on which tropical forests stand is not fertile and suitable for agriculture. When you clear away the trees, the tropical thunderstorms rapidly wash away the soil and its nutrients, or they compact it. You lose thousands of species. At the same time, it is difficult to explain this to a third world leader. I remember once going to Nigeria and saying to a minister there, are you quite sure that you really feel it's in your best long-term interests to clear away your forests until the last tree is gone? And he said, well, you come from Britain, and just remember that Britain was once a sea of forest from one end to another, and you guys cut down that forest with which to build the British Navy and to conquer half the world, including Nigeria. And it's hard to give a response to a comment like that.
What are the major kinds of concerns that policymakers need to be aware of in considering the connections between human populations and biological populations or plant populations?
I would just say one thing is that they need to have some time perspective on some things. Policymakers should look back 2 years for every one that they project into the future, at least as a rule of thumb. Maybe 3 years for every year that they make a projection into the future. That is, they should look backward as well as forward to see what's been going on. And it isn't. And often you find that policymakers have carried out the same debate. If you get people who are talking about forest problems and so forth in the 1980s in a place like India, why, they've carried out the same debate maybe in the 1920s. Maybe the terminology is a little different, but the issues have been very similar. And we can look back and see the impact of those decisions that were made then, and that when that debate was carried out in the 1920s.
John, I wonder if I could just add something. As a historian, you talked about the increasing interdependence of the world, and that's absolutely true, nations upon nations, people upon people. As a geographer, I think I've also, in my training, been very conscious of the interdependence of the whole environment, one piece upon another. The idea of the soil, the vegetation, the trees, the runoff, the evaporation, the wildlife, all these things are interdependent in a system of some form or another. And that, I think, is another important concept which needs to be in the forefront of any policymaker's mind.
I just think of a couple of examples that I've been working on recently that are exactly like that. In the years of the 70s, when we've been so terribly concerned over world energy supplies, a lot of the hope that many of us had 20 years ago that nuclear energy would provide the answers to an industrialized world in the future, that hope has been slowly, steadily vanishing. And we think back nostalgically to 20 years ago when we all had bumper stickers saying "Atoms for Peace." And we don't have those bumper stickers any longer. So in many parts of the world, and the Third World has even more severe energy problems by far than what some of the industrialized countries do, there's been a good deal of hope that hydroelectric power would provide a good piece of their energy requirements, and furthermore, the high dam for hydropower that you would build in the mountains of any tropical country that you want to think of, that high dam would not have any radioactive wastes, and so there wouldn't be that kind of problem in generating energy supplies. And furthermore, it's likely to be raining next year, and it's likely still to be raining, and mountains are likely still to be collecting water power resources 50 years from now, even if there were no more coal, even if there were no more petroleum reserves on Earth. And then there, too, it turns out it's not half so simple as we had hoped, because a number of the high dams that have been built in various parts of the world in the last 20 years, last 50 years, if you like, have been built primarily by engineers and energy planners. Irrigation officials often have had a key role to play in this kind of thing. And it turns out in numerous examples, including some in India that I've been working on recently, that instead of expecting that your dam can have 200 years of active life before the slow siltation rate in the river behind it fills up the reservoir, in some cases these estimates turned out to be just wildly ill-informed. Instead of 200 years, it turns out that a particular dam will have a 40-year, or a 50-year, or a 28-year life. And that means that the whole financial structure of it, just for one thing, turns out in a badly planned case like that to be, well, it was a poor investment. Ecologically, in a case like this, it's also a desperately poor investment because prime land is usually disrupted or changed from one use to another with a very short useful lifetime. People, wildlife, often prime forests are displaced, and if the payoff is only for a very short period, the local area at least has turned out to have a very poor investment of it. And downstream still, there are people who need industrial development energy, who need energy and its irrigation implications.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion about the world economy and the world's forests. The panelists recently participated in a conference on that topic, sponsored by the Center for International Studies at Duke University. In the following portion of the conversation, the speakers are Richard Tucker, John Richards, David Feeney, and Norman Myers. Richard Tucker is an environmental historian at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. John Richards teaches history at Duke University. David Feeney is an economic historian at McMaster University in Canada. Norman Myers is an independent scholar and researcher based in Oxford, England. Here is Richard Tucker.
We've been dealing with a polarized situation in which the dam builders have been overly enthusiastic and overly narrow in the range of issues that they call on in the planning process. The forest interests, those people whose first consciousness is the trees, move in, find the poorly planned and poorly built dams to be an easy target, but usually the tree lovers, the people who are concerned for forests and watershed stabilization, have no answers yet for where we're going to find energy supplies for the desperate industrialization needs, which are such a common element in many third world countries. So far, that sounds very discouraging. I guess all we've learned about it so far, and all that historians have been able to contribute so far, is the insistence that all of these issues are interrelated, whether we like them to be or not, that planning processes have got to take them all into account, whether we want to or not, even if it slows down some of our development strategies. And I think that internationally we've made a great deal of progress just over the last 5 or 6 years in getting the various specialists to talk with each other, to understand each other's language, so that planning processes to balance economic development with long-range environmental preservation, these planning processes we may be steadily improving on. And certainly if we have better historical perspective on both our mistakes and our successes, that's likely to help.
I just add one thing to that, Wayne. I think that the one of the phrases that we rather liked at the conference was the term exuberant ignorance. Mm-hmm. And the fact that in certain kinds of projects, people went ahead and carried them out, regardless of the impact on forests. These are public projects which might have a major impact on how land is used and that sort of thing, where decisions are made by people looking at very real, rational gains to be made, but not really taking the historical record into account and not really taking the environment into account in a very large and interlocking kind of way. And it's that kind of exuberant ignorance of going ahead and doing things that we're really concerned about in some respects, I think.
Wayne, if I can just reiterate a little bit on the doing economic history, one is also struck with the continuity of these issues. There's another continuity there, and I think that reemphasize one of the points that Norman made, that there's a very big difference in the ecological system between a temperate and tropical zone forest. And this also goes back to that lovely exuberant ignorance phrase that Candace Goucher brought up during the conference. That was describing the very intelligent German civil servant agriculturalists who arrived in Togo, knowing nothing of tropical farming, tropical ecosystems, and who thought they could immensely improve on what the African peasants were doing. And soon discovered that indeed the people who had been there for hundreds of years and through trial and error, maybe without systematic scientific methodology, but had evolved a not bad system at all. This story is replayed throughout Asia. It took a long time for the agricultural scientists to learn enough about tropical crops to generate major gains in productivity through agricultural research. It wasn't just a matter of transplanting what had been done at Beltsville in Maryland to rice research in the Philippines. And in fact, as we know, it's only in the 1960s and 70s that really large gains, in part derived from much earlier investments in the 10s and 20s, are realized.
The total amount of money being spent on basic research on what makes tropical rainforest tick is, I believe, worldwide, about $30 million. Now, I could compare that with the sum of less than $30 billion that was required to send a man to the moon, and it's not going too far to say that we now know more about certain sectors of the moon's surface than we do about some of the heartlands in Amazonia. And the moon is going to be around in undisturbed state for an awful long time to come. Many scientists offer as a considered opinion that we really need a kind of Manhattan Project, a crash program, to find out what makes these tropical forests work and how we can get them to work better in support of human welfare, not as an abstract academic exercise, but as a priority objective to support the billions of third world people who live in the tropical forest zone and who have a pretty thin time of it right now. We could also consider, in a broad sense, that a tropical forest, at any rate, constitute the major powerhouse of evolution. This is where many more species have come into being than in any other ecological zone on Earth. These tropical forests cover only about 1/15 of Earth's land surface, and yet they contain almost half of all species on Earth. If these forests continue to disappear, we're going to lose hundreds of thousands, perhaps 1 or 2 million species in those forests within the next couple of decades, and perhaps even more significant, we shall fundamentally modify and perhaps impoverish the future course of evolution for maybe another 10 or 20 million years. Now, perhaps after due thought and as a carefully considered and informed opinion, that is what we shall finally decide serves the best interests of humankind. But I do think that we should consider, if you will, to use a very large word, we should consider some of the ethical dimensions of that situation and ask ourselves, do we really want to impose a decision of that sort, an irreversible decision, on thousands of generations of our descendants?
People sometimes think of ethics as an individual kind of concern. I mean, this is what, you know, we think of the Ten Commandments, we think of various kinds of ways where we try to lead ethical lives, tell our children and show them by example how to lead ethical lives. But I think the biggest human problem is really group ethics. That is, the nation state or the state or the province or the ethnic group making and contributing to making moral decisions in terms of the collective good of humanity and in various ways. And that's a problem we have not yet resolved, and our nation state system, the way it operates today, is an example of a certain kind of failure in this regard. And so in the long run and in the short run, we're talking about making ethical decisions which have an impact on the future, as Norman has suggested, and they're ethical decisions which have to be made by groups, and groups have to come to some kind of agreement on what they want. And this is a very basic kind of decision which we are going to have to make very rapidly, because those chainsaws are out there working right now.
And just to follow up on that point, there's a real problem in the group deciding what it wants, and then there are individuals who are members of the group, and then there are problems in designing institutions, regulations, and social mores, perhaps norms that will get the individual to act in concert with the decision of the group. And that's in forest exploitation, that's a problem which we come and encounter very frequently. But the sort of long-range genetic pool preservation, that this is a real issue, obviously, for not just Homo sapiens, who are sitting here talking about this, but all the other species as well.
John mentioned that the chainsaws are at work right now, and we've got to be pretty sharp in making our decision. Let us also bear in mind that the hands on those chainsaws are not only the hands of Brazilians and Nigerians, Indonesians, but they're also, in an indirect sense, those hands belong to Americans, Britishers, Australians, Japanese. More than half of all the timber that is cut for commercial purposes in tropical forests makes its way into the rich nations, where it's used for parquet floors and fine furniture, weekend yachts. There's a whole long line of uses. I'm sure each listener can just look around the room in which he or she is sitting right now and see half a dozen items. So everybody's hand is on that chainsaw at work. We're all involved in the process. I believe that if the forests continue to disappear in this unconsidered fashion, we shall all suffer. And so, as I believe John suggested earlier on, we need a concerted effort at international level, indeed on behalf of all humankind, to try to safeguard these forests, or at any rate to do a better job of putting them to the best long-term use that will serve the broadest ultimate needs of humankind.
And is there a blueprint like this? Does one exist in the United Nations, in the heads of scientists and historians?
A lot of the discussion and the planning on this is not so much at that level as on the level of individual countries. And within Southeast Asia, for example, the area where the tropical rainforest has been cut and depleted most rapidly and most dangerously in the last 30 years, there's begun to be quite a turnaround in some of the planning agencies of Southeast Asian governments, countries like Thailand, countries like Indonesia, with the realization just within the last 5, 6, 8 years that their resource, one of the major forms of income for those governments, to say nothing else of their other values, is being depleted so rapidly that they're beginning to be in about the kind of position that some of the OPEC countries are for their oil reserves, and beginning to say, we don't want to harvest all of that timber any more than Saudi Arabia wants to harvest all of its oil resources within the next 20 years. In those countries particularly, we're beginning to find a much longer perspective emerging in some among some of their planners. And I'm encouraged by that, but of course the time is short, the time pressure is very, very great.
In terms of the blueprint issue, there are a number of UN agencies concerned and conferences. I'd also like to suggest that there's the need for the rise of a major international separate research institute. Many of the gains in agricultural research for food grain crops came from new institutional designs like the International Rice Research Institute that was started in the Philippines in the early 1960s, which had donors from a wide variety of countries, private foundations, and has its critics, and rightfully so, but has generated some very interesting and important potential gains and realized gains to a certain extent in the productivity of growing fruit grains and the obvious food population issue, which generated that, as we now are becoming much more concerned with biosphere or international environmental issues. Part of where that blueprint will come from and the way of getting scientists and informed and concerned people together is that institutional structure of a multilateral above nations international research center on these kinds of issues, which since all nation states and all the research that is done by government agencies within nation states is a mixture of both the scientific results and the self-interest of those nations. I'm not a scientist, so I have no self-interest in forming this kind of institution, so you can take that as a somewhat more objective suggestion.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a discussion about the world economy and the world forests in the 20th century. The panelists were John Richards of Duke University, Norman Myers of Oxford, England, David Feeney of McMaster University, Richard Tucker of Oakland University, and Michael Williams of Oxford University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a program entitled The World Economy and the World's Forests, an Historical Overview. Scholars have only recently begun to examine environmental issues in cumulative historical terms, and historians are now examining the environment as a manifestation of cultural interdependence, particularly with an eye to third world societies. A panel of scholars from Duke, McMaster, Oakland, and Oxford universities discusses the status of the world's forests. How has this crucial environmental condition evolved? And what are some of its important cultural, social, and economic elements? The World Economy and the World's Forests, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.